Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. In this hour, state lawmakers have reworked CEQA, the state's landmark environmental law, in hopes of speeding up housing construction. Supporters call it long overdue, but critics say it opens the door to unchecked development and risks California's ecosystems and low-income communities. So we'll unpack what the new rules mean for your neighborhood and for the future of the state. And later, we'll be joined by New York Times bestselling author Layla Motley, who will talk about The Girls Who Grew Big, her new novel about a fierce group of teenage mothers in a small town on the Florida panhandle. But first, we're talking about the future of affordable health care here in the Bay Area and in California more generally. On July 4th, President Trump signed his big tax bill into law, a sweeping package of tax breaks and spending cuts that's expected to disrupt the country's healthcare system. While Medicaid, or Medi-Cal as it's known here, faces deep reductions in funding from this new law, California's own insurance marketplace, Covered California, is also under threat. Now, since the Affordable Care Act took effect more than a decade ago, millions of Californians have gained coverage through the exchange. But now, with federal subsidies slashed and new mandates in place, state officials are warning that hundreds of thousands of Californians could lose coverage or drop out due to rising costs. Here to explain the implications of the tax bill is Jessica Altman, Executive Director of Covered California. Welcome to State of the Bay, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
So it's great to have you here and explain what's going on. This is obviously a moving picture here, moving target, I should say. And before we dive into Trump's bill, let's just start with the basics. What is Covered California and who does your organization serve?
It's such a great question because I know our healthcare system is confusing. So Covered California is really a marketplace for health insurance. We generally serve any Californian that doesn't have stable health insurance from another source, doesn't have it from their job, isn't eligible for Medi-Cal, not old enough for Medicare. So people who are working on an hourly basis, not getting health insurance, people who are in the gig economy, freelancers, contractors, people who retire before 65, those are the types of people that rely on Covered California. And today we cover nearly 2 million Californians, around 90% of whom receive tax credits that the federal government makes available to bring the cost of the health insurance that we offer within reach. And I know we're going to talk a lot more about that affordability today.
And Jessica, how is Covered California different from Medicaid or Medi-Cal, as it's known in California?
Yeah, Medi-Cal, which is California's Medicaid program, really is overseen by the state to serve our populations most in need. So if you make an income below a certain level in California, you are eligible for Medi-Cal. All other categories of people like children, pregnant women, people with a disability get special access to Medi-Cal as well. Covered California, again, is for anyone that doesn't have health insurance from another source, including Medi-Cal, though we do work hand in hand with Medi-Cal to look at your situation, your household, your income, and make sure that you get to the right place between our programs.
And let's talk about the big tax bill that passed, signed on July 4th. As I mentioned, it was passed on a completely party line vote, all Republicans in favor, although there were some defections in the Republican side in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. Now, it has gotten a fair amount of publicity that's going to have some wide-ranging impacts on our healthcare system. Can you give us a lay of the land? What are the most significant changes being proposed to healthcare coverage at the federal level? And how are you expecting this might impact Covered California specifically?
Yeah, I mean, this is an incredibly wide-ranging bill, covering policies from taxation to immigration to energy and the environment, and then huge sweeping changes to healthcare. And even though you're right, this bill has gotten a lot of attention, there's so much in it that it's impossible for all of the individual pieces of it to really get the attention that they're due when you have this much policy moving as quickly as this bill did in Washington. One thing we have heard a lot about, but there's more here to learn and to talk about, is the significant cuts to federal funding for Medicaid, therefore for Medi-Cal here in California. And we're gonna, as a state, be feeling those impacts for years to come. But there are also impacts for the marketplace. In particular, broadly across the healthcare system for our immigrant communities. So on the marketplace side, We're looking at significantly higher costs for marketplace enrollees. We're looking at a lot more red tape, just making the process to get enrolled and to stay enrolled harder than it is today, really in an effort to just keep people from enrolling in a lot of ways. And limiting flexibility that marketplaces like Covered California have to react in those moments. I mentioned healthcare for immigrant communities as well. There are reductions in which healthcare programs in our country legal immigrants are eligible for. Historically, there have been different rules that let our legal immigrants get access with federal dollars to Medi-Cal and Medicaid, to Medicare, and to marketplaces and the tax credits that we provide. But they're really pulling back on that, and including for Cover California, where certain and really most categories of legal immigrants will lose all of the financial assistance that we make available and is funded by the federal government. So, some incredibly sweeping changes that are in different ways going to impact really all of the 2 million people, nearly 2 million people that we cover, not to mention those that rely on the Medi-Cal program.
So if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jessica Altman, Executive Director of Covered California. We're talking about the impacts of the tax bill that President Trump just signed into law on July 4th and what it means for healthcare coverage in the Bay Area and in California, and specifically for those signed up through Covered California. Jessica, as you take your crystal ball out and look into the future with subsidies being reduced, what's your predictions for what's going to happen to the affordability of healthcare coverage and enrollment rates in Covered California specifically, but perhaps even beyond that, if you can make a prediction on what might happen outside of your program?
So to start with a little background here, one of the most notable things for marketplaces in this bill, in addition to what's in it, is what wasn't in it. And what wasn't in it was an extension of more generous tax credits that we've been offering for years that have resulted in enrollment and marketplaces across the country doubling since 2021. That are set to expire at the end of this year unless Congress proactively acts to extend them. And so as we look at that expiration, the level of affordability that we have today that's driven record enrollment in California as well as nationally, this would mean an average 66% increase in what our enrollees pay on a monthly basis after receiving that tax credit. Many people will still receive tax credits, they'll just be less generous, but we are gonna see many of the middle income Californians, hardworking Californians that we cover losing tax credits altogether and looking at paying the full cost of coverage. It's an average increase of over $100 per month per person on Cover California. So it really is significant. And of course, that comes at a time when we know Californians and Americans are feeling costs across the board for things they need, from rent to food to childcare to transportation. And so healthcare and this level of increase in healthcare costs is really the last thing that Californians and Americans need right now.
In addition to limiting eligibility for financial help, how else might this bill limit access to Covered California coverage?
Yeah, when we look across actually both the bill and some new federal regulations, we're looking just at a whole lot more red tape, a whole lot more bureaucracy, less time to enroll in future years, telling us we've been, you know, automatically renewing people in their health insurance for years. Over 70% of the people we cover, we can just kind of run them through data we have on the back end, no problem, stay covered, just like it works for you know, the majority of people that get their coverage from their employer. You don't have to reapply and resubmit paperwork every year when you get health insurance through your job. We can no longer do that. So every year, people that just want to stay covered with exactly what they have are gonna have to come back in and do paperwork really for no reason. We'll also have to make sure that all the paperwork is done and verified. And if your income doesn't match what our data sources tell us, we have to actually look at a document. We can't give you a tax credit until all of that is done, which is very different than what we do today and is really gonna create this barrier where people will either have to wait and not enroll, or they're going to have to pay the full cost without the tax credit while they wait for their paperwork to be processed. So these are some of the things that are going to come in future years that are just going to make government and cover California less efficient. And again, we don't think it's going to provide any benefit to the people that we serve or help us do our job better.
And just thinking about the broader impacts, even for those not signed up for healthcare coverage through Covered California, what do you think these cuts might do to the broader healthcare system in California, including for clinics and hospitals?
So one of the incredible, I mean, we talk a lot about the Affordable Care Act and California driving our uninsured rate down more than any other state in the nation from over 17% to 6%, the incredible progress we've made over the past decade. And one of the things that has done is reduce what's called uncompensated care. Because in this country, if you have an emergency, if you need healthcare and you walk into the emergency room, they're going to give you the care that you need, whether or not you have health insurance. And if you don't have health insurance, our system will bear the cost. And so when you look at what is really going to be a burden on our hospitals and our healthcare providers of having to provide healthcare to people who don't have the ability to pay for it. Obviously, that's a burden on the patients, but it's also a burden on the hospitals. Around the country, there have already been some stories of clinics and hospitals closing or not reopening as a result. And of course, in many communities, particularly more rural communities, hospitals are the number one employer where they live. And so we're also potentially looking at reductions in jobs and impact to the economy in California and around the country. I mean, healthcare is fundamental to us as human beings and families, but it really is also fundamental to our state and our economy and all of our well-being and ability to thrive. And it's just going to have far-reaching impacts, not to mention the other pieces of this big bill, things like cuts to food assistance that are just going to hit people from a lot of different sides.
We only have a couple of minutes left here. I just wanted to find out from you, what is the state doing, if anything? I'm assuming stuff's happening to try to mitigate the impacts of these cuts.
Yeah, I'll say two things. I mean, first of all, Congress could still extend the tax credits, right? Unlike some of the things that they did and proactively put in the bill, this one they just haven't acted. And so I do think that's one piece where we're going to be laser focused from now until open enrollment begins, focusing on what is the impact of this, why does it matter, who does it matter for? And unlike other things in the bill where the impact isn't going to be felt for a year, 2 years, 3 years, we are putting notices in the mail in 3 months telling 2 million Californians what their costs are going to be next year to say more. And there are 24 million Americans enrolled in the marketplaces who are going to get similar letters. So that's first, like this one, there is maybe still a window and the argument needs to be made. The other is we're incredibly privileged to be in the state of California that cares about healthcare, invests in access. And through the state budget that just passed, Cover California is receiving almost $200 million to invest in affordability, really with the goal of mitigating as much of this impact as we can. Now, that being said, that's incredible. This is a very difficult year for the state budget. And so to have that investment really shows how much the leaders in this state care about Covered California and those that we serve. But the federal enhanced tax credits are $2 billion. And so we're not going to be able to fully make this right, to fully fill that hole. But we're going to do everything that we can. And then finally, it's just about communicating and telling Covered California's enrollees what could be happening, what it means. Knowledge is power, and people need to stay informed, and we're going to help them do that.
Great. Well, we appreciate you coming on State of the Bay to explain what's happening. There's obviously a lot more that we could talk about, and we do plan to revisit coverage of this issue in the future on State of the Bay here. But Jessica Altman, Executive Director of Covered California, thank you for coming on and just explaining what's at stake and what some of the next step plans are for Covered California and the state of California as a whole on this issue. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for shedding a light on it. It's important.
Absolutely. Coming up next, after this short break, we're going to be back with the pros and cons of the recent reforms to California's Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. So stay with us.
I'm I'm Miriam Goodman.
And I'm Lynn Winter-Gross. We're the hosts of Not Born Yesterday, KALW's first podcast in residence. Each week, we explore the joys and challenges of aging with experts in the field.
And in our next episode, we're reconsidering the music and fashions of our times with legendary music journalist Ben Fong-Torres and Sean Grain Carter from the Fashion Institute of Technology.
Join us Mondays at 7 p.m. right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. A legendary Oakland baller blazes trails for queer representation in the WNBA.
I think growing up Black and being a lesbian in our community was very, very different. There's like these boxes that you gotta fit into, and when you don't fit into those boxes, you're kind of just like out here.
It's a new episode of Bounce. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. At the end of last month, California passed the most sweeping overhaul of its landmark environmental review law since its inception back in 1970. The California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, was originally designed to ensure that projects with significant impacts to the environment would reduce those impacts if possible and give decision makers and the public information in advance about what was at stake with any particular project. And in recent years, however, it's become a flashpoint in the fight over housing. It's been blamed by some for blocking urgently needed housing development while being praised by others for giving communities a voice. Under pressure to address the state's housing shortage, Governor Gavin Newsom and lawmakers have pushed through changes that dramatically scale back CEQA's reach, especially for new housing in cities and urbanized areas. Supporters call it a long overdue fix. Critics say the rollback could open the door to unchecked development. And tonight, we're going to dig into what's changed, why it matters, and what California stands to gain or lose. And we're very pleased to be joined by Kim Delfino, president and founder of Earth Advocacy, a consulting company that provides policy and advocacy guidance to nonprofits and foundations with the goal of protecting and restoring ecosystems for future generations. Welcome to State of the Bay, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Liam Dillon, the California Housing Affordability and Neighborhood Change Reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Liam.
Ethan, thanks for having me. It is nice to be on with such an eminent CEQA-ologist such as yourself.
I appreciate it. Never been called a CEQA-ologist before, so I'm putting that on my business card. I appreciate that.
There you go.
And finally, I want to welcome Chris Elmendorf, University of California Davis professor specializing in land use law. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Chris.
Thanks. It's great to be back. Appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. It's great to have all three of you on for this segment. CEQA is definitely a deep dive subject, so it's wonderful to have you all on. And State of the Bay listeners, we're opening up the phone lines tonight. We'd love to hear from you. What questions or concerns do you have about the new reforms to the California Environmental Quality Act? Have you been involved in a CEQA lawsuit? Have you benefited from CEQA or been hurt by CEQA in some way? We'd love to hear from you. The phone lines are open and you can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions or comments you have at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or go ahead and find us on social media. We're on Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. So Liam, let's first, just for listeners who may not be familiar, get a quick history of CEQA. Can you talk about what CEQA was originally designed to do?
Sure. It was part of passed in 1970 and signed, as many people will often note, by then Governor Ronald Reagan. It's a really simple law in many respects that was kind of along the lines of a lot of environmental laws that were being passed in the sort of the late 60s, early 70s period, when the environmental movement in the United States really was coming to the fore. And so CEQA essentially says that proponents of a project have to disclose, and if possible, lessen the environmental effects of that project before it actually being approved. And so at base, it's a pretty simple law that's about disclosure. It's about mitigating impacts. And I think, like, over time, what has happened, at least in some respects, is you end up getting these, you know, lengthy environmental reports, testing for noise and soil, and it becomes, you know, can become for some projects this sort of, you know, bear of a process to get through.
And Liam, I know you've reported on many of those examples of being a bear of a process for housing developers, and you've covered some of these CEQA lawsuits that have delayed housing projects. I'm just wondering if you could share an example or two of some of the high-profile CEQA lawsuits that I think have given some fuel to this fire to, that has led to the reforms we just saw.
Yeah, and I think what has happened is sort of for better or for worse, right? This has become, and I can talk more about this, sort of this point of leverage in the development process in California, where anybody and everybody can say that there may be an environmental problem with a project and cause some headwinds for it. So, like, for instance, there's a pretty famous example of a gas station owner in San Jose who sued a nearby rival gas station that wanted to add a few more pumps under CEQA. There were pro-life advocates who sued a proposed Planned Parenthood clinic in South San Francisco, homeowners in Berkeley suing the University of California over plans to increase enrollment at the school, arguing that traffic and noise would result from that. And so a lot of things beyond, I think, what people think of just kind of like major highway projects or major infrastructure projects can get caught in and deal with some, the responsibilities under CEQA.
And Kim Delfino, to bring you into this conversation, from your perspective, are these examples the exception or would you view them as the rule? I mean, how do you respond to claims that CEQA has blocked too many housing construction projects specifically in California, as well as other projects that many people would look at as an environmental good?
So I would say that they're more the exception than the rule. When you look at the number of projects that are moving forward, housing, all kinds of projects, they, for the most part, move through the CEQA process pretty smoothly. Unfortunately, we do have some of these more extreme examples of where people abuse the process. And unfortunately, the response to that is, well, we'll just get rid of the process and that'll solve the problem. But as I'm sure we'll talk about later, it then deprives communities, disadvantaged communities and others who have been historically burdened by pollution and are more disenfranchised from being able to have a voice in, what happens in their backyard.
And Chris, let me turn to you. Liam gave an overview of the history of CEQA very briefly. I'm wondering if you could shed a little light on just some of the major changes to CEQA over the years and what have been the sort of common criticisms that you've come across as you've been studying CEQA and its long history here in California.
So criticisms of CEQA as a cause of delay over important projects really started to come to a head, I would say, around 2010, 2015, in that period. And the legislature started passing one-off exemptions or provisions for accelerated judicial review of certain CEQA projects, like a sports stadium was the early canonical example. And then as housing came to the fore and became an increasing concern for the legislature starting around 2016, 2017. There's a lot of advocacy around creating CEQA exemptions for dense infill housing, that is townhomes, apartment buildings, condos that are built on sites that are surrounded by other urban uses. The theory being that if people are living in these relatively compact forms, typically near transit or in walkable neighborhoods, they have much less of an environmental impact than if they're living in the wildland urban interface or out in some sprawling suburb. And so if developers want to build housing of these relatively environmentally friendly forms, they shouldn't be held up by an environmental law. And the principal objection to that idea of streamlining CEQA or eliminating CEQA review for those infill housing projects came from labor unions. It wasn't an environmental objection. The concern was that if this class of projects is taken out of CEQA, then unions will lose the leverage they have presently to impose delay costs on developers, and by imposing those delay costs to have leverage that pressures developers into signing agreements with labor union to use workers that are much more expensive than the non-union workers that the developers might otherwise use.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the political dynamic that I know Liam has been tracking, labor union involvement. Liam, I know you've got to go in just a couple minutes here. I wanted to just give you an opportunity to just tell us a bit about what just happened with these CEQA reforms. What kinds of projects are now exempt? How has the law been changed?
Yeah, so there was, as part of the state budget process, and in fact, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom used pretty significant leverage that he had in that budget process to essentially, and this is not too strong, sort of strong arm the legislature into passing passing these reforms. So there were two measures, principal measures. One essentially exempted urban housing development along the lines of what Chris was discussing, mid-rise and low-rise projects from CEQA entirely in a clean way without sort of any add-ons. So no requirements to pay union workers union level wages or other benefits. And that's, you know, been fairly unique in the number of the housing reforms that have passed the legislature over the past decade or so, that there's no add-on for labor or for otherwise. Now, I will note that projects that are 100% these urban projects that are 100% affordable or are high-rise projects, those do have some labor requirements attached, but those labor requirements generally were part of the process of approval anyway. So that's why this is sort of seen as, at least on the housing perspective, sort of this landmark change in how the development process, the negotiating process happens in the state. There was another set of changes that occurred. A lot more of those one-off exemptions that again Chris had mentioned. The legislature packed a bunch in there. So health clinics, food pantries, some things that again high-profile examples where there had been lawsuits against particular projects. The legislature said these will be exempt. And I think most specifically and of concern to the environmental community is that there was an exemption that was granted for advanced manufacturing facilities. And so that could be some of these like sort of semiconductor plants or other things that were anticipated as part of the Biden administration's funding programs. But I know a lot of concern among the environmental community that this exemption in particular went too far and could have some significant negative effects on affected communities.
And I assume there'll be some potential efforts at cleanup legislation. What are you anticipating going forward?
We'll see. I mean, literally, as I'm sitting here looking at my inbox, there was a recall from the NRDC to make changes to these CEQA reforms in particular. And so I think there'll be significant pressure from environmental groups in the legislature. But whether that happens or not, I think remains to be seen.
Well, Liam, I know you have to go, but I just want to thank you so much for joining us. You are a CEQAologist as well. I'll bestow that.
Very kind. Thank you. Yes.
So Liam Dillon, housing affordability and neighborhood change reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
All right. And we're going to stick on this issue. If you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about California's landmark environmental law, CEQA, and the major reforms just signed into law by Governor Gavin Newsom. You just heard from Liam Dillon from the LA Times, but we're also still joined by Chris Elmendorf, a law professor from UC Davis, and Kim Delfino, lawyer and founder of Earth Advocacy. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Do you think these changes to CEQA will make it easier to build affordable housing in your community? Or are you concerned about the potential risks to our environment and ecosystems from rolling back these CEQA requirements? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Chris, one of the major reforms, as Liam mentioned, was exempting most urban infill housing now from CEQA. I'm curious what kind of impacts you think this might have on California's ability to build more homes. I mean, will this really unlock a lot of new housing in your view?
I would say it's one piece of the puzzle, but there are many other pieces too. And for California to make significant headway, all the different pieces of the puzzle have to come together. So one piece is process. That's what the CEQA reforms address. They'll substantially reduce the risk of delay. They'll also help to depoliticize decisions because fewer projects will be appealed to city councils, and they'll take away one point of leverage through which third parties are able to impose significant costs and extract concessions from developers. But there's still zoning, which operates as a barrier that has limits on height and density. There's another important bill pending in the legislature now that would allow for much more height and density near fixed transit, and we'll see if that passes. There are still very high impact fees and exactions and affordability requirements that are imposed by local governments, not through CEQA, which make it very expensive to build. And then the elephant in the room perhaps is Proposition 13, which creates a disincentive for people to sell their property. It slows turnover of property. It also means that local governments get less revenue from development than they do in many other states. And so it operates as maybe a political disincentive for cities to approve housing. So I would say the CEQA reforms are very important, but they're not a silver bullet standing alone.
And Kim Delfino, where were environmental advocates, if we can sort of generalize, I know there's diversity of opinions there, where were they generally on that provision about exempting urban infill housing? Was that a source of controversy, or were there other provisions, perhaps some that Liam described, that have been much more concerning, generally speaking, to environmental advocates?
Yeah, the infill housing provisions were not a concern. I think we all agree we need to be doing more to do more compact, dense development near transit, more affordable housing. So that was not the issue that the conservation or environmental community had. And the infill housing provisions were in one bill, Assembly Bill 130. The bill that I think has given folks a lot of heartburn is Senate Bill 131. And as already was noted, you know, advanced manufacturing has a broad CEQA exemption. So if you have an advanced manufacturing project, you have no sideboards. You know, it's not like you have to be set back a certain amount from a community or a school. And the definition is incredibly broad. It can include chemical recycling, which is basically the burning of plastics. It can include pharmaceutical manufacturing, semiconductor projects, biogas and biofuels, fuel cell manufacturing, nuclear fusion technology. I mean, the list is actually rather stunning in scope. And these projects now have no requirement to involve community input or to do an analysis of what their impacts might be on a community in terms of, you know, air emissions, toxic air emissions, hazardous waste. So that was definitely one of the big problems for us.
And Kim, when we think about environmental issues, you know, we have a whole slate of environmental laws already in place. We have the Endangered Species Act, both the federal version and the state version. We have the Clean Air Act. Why aren't those laws sufficient to be able to protect communities from some of the harms you just described? Where does CEQA fit into that legal landscape?
So CEQA is kind of your first step, where it's your first look. So from an endangered species or a habitat perspective, CEQA gives you the opportunity for a biologist to go out on the ground and sort of take a look at what's out there and then report back. Yeah, there's habitat here. There's oak woodlands. These are things you need to take into consideration. And then that would then trigger something, say, like the Endangered Species Act. So if someone goes out there under CEQA, takes a look at the land, it's on the land. Oh, there's, you know, mountain lions or, you know, some endangered birds or whatever, you know, and then that would then trigger the Endangered Species Act and the need to comply with that and to mitigate for your impacts to those species. If you don't have CEQA, you're essentially taking a head in the sand approach that then potentially would result in not triggering these other permits because you don't actually have any information about what's out there on the ground to begin with. And, you know, and this can same go for tribal and cultural resources. A lot of the tribes are concerned because now you won't be going out and looking to see what's out there. Are there remains? Are there important, you know, tribal cultural resources? It's kind of a backwards approach. And if you, I guess it's, you know, if you don't know, then you're not required to mitigate for it. You're not required to take it into consideration.
So we have an email question, and Paul in San Francisco writes, how will these new changes affect labor unions who work on housing projects in cities? And Chris, I know you had referenced this as one of the sort of dynamics involved in CEQA. How do you read these changes and how they might affect labor? What did labor get or lose out of these reforms that just passed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there had been an effort to negotiate a construction worker minimum wage that would be higher than the minimum wage that applies across the board in California, be specific to the construction industry. And the first draft of the budget trailer bill that had this infill housing exemption also defined this new construction minimum wage, or two tiers to it, and said, if you're going to get the CEQA exemption, you need to pay your workers the construction minimum wage, which was like about or a little bit higher than the average or the median construction wage in most markets. So basically saying pay your workers about average if you want the CEQA exemption, not bottom of the barrel. And the building and construction trade union went ballistic over this. They said, like, we don't like this construction wage idea at all. They compared it to slavery and Jim Crow, chain gangs. But their fundamental concern is that it was different from the wages they have negotiated. The wages they have negotiated, which are called prevailing wages, are typically about twice as high as the market wage. And so the idea of defining a fair wage that was not based on their own negotiations was anathema to them. And so ironically, part of the compromise was to remove the construction minimum wage provision, which would have been to the benefit of the vast majority of construction workers in the state, and instead to require that on high-rise projects, the developers use union labor if at least three union-affiliated contractors bid on the project. So the very small number of very highly paid members of the building construction trade union got protection for their work on high-rises at the expense of the much larger number of workers who are just your Joe construction laborer.
If you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the sweeping new reforms to CEQA, or California's Environmental Review Law, and how they might reshape housing and ecosystems across the state. We'd love to hear from you as well. Has CEQA helped or hurt your community? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or go ahead and email us with any questions or comments at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We're joined by Christopher Elmendorf, a University of California Davis law professor specializing in land use law, and Kim Delfino, president and founder of Earth Advocacy. Listener Johanna in Oakland writes, CEQA is an important tool for environmental justice and community agency. I'm concerned these reforms will weaken that power. Kim, you referenced this earlier when your first response about just how important CEQA has been for low-income environmental justice communities. Can you speak to that concern?
Yeah, I think, you know, CEQA has become really important to those communities because for the most part, a lot of times they're sort of left out of the larger decision-making process. You know, in terms of general plans, general plan updates, zoning. So, you know, people don't tend to understand or know what's happening until a project is actually being proposed right there in their city or in their neighborhood. And so a lot, when you talk to the environmental justice organizations, they use CEQA all the time, not for litigation. What they use it for is to inform folks, you know, hey, this project is coming. You should be paying attention to this. What questions do you have? Here's how you can engage and write a comment letter or appear at the public hearing associated with that project. Here are the questions you should be asking to find out more about, like, what kind of pollution is there going to be? How many trucks will be driving by your house? You know, how are you going to limit noise or whatever? You know, that's been the real value of CEQA. And when you take it away, there really isn't anything to substitute for it. And so then folks are nearly shut out of the process.
And Christopher, as we think about potential ongoing changes to CEQA, as well as trying to really absorb what was changed here, I'm curious if you feel like these reforms will ultimately help California meet its goals? Or are there other areas of reform that you would have liked to have seen that didn't make it into this bill. What's your assessment about, you know, not just what happened, although that's important, but also what else might be needed going forward?
So what Senator Wiener tried to do with Senate Bill 131, which was one of the two bills that was rolled into the package, was to create essentially a new CEQA that would apply in some parts of the states and to some kinds of projects, and an old CEQA that would continue to apply in other parts of the states and to certain narrow classes of projects. And the key idea he had for divvying up projects in the state was to say, we're going to define certain lands as natural and protected lands. Those are the lands we really want to protect. And on those lands, old CEQA will continue to apply, and none of the new exemptions will apply, and we'll be super, super careful about doing anything without a thorough, thorough environmental study. If there's any doubt about whether some impact might be significant, we'll do more study of it before the project goes forward. And then outside of that category of natural and protected lands, we should let the agency that is permitting the project, whether that's a city council or a state agency, the agency that's in charge of the project, they should get the benefit of the doubt about how much environmental study is necessary. And courts shouldn't be micromanaging their decisions about how much environmental study is necessary. We'll still have CEQA, we'll still have the principle of doing some environmental studies. But when there's doubt about how much is enough, the benefit of the doubt goes to the agency that's approving the project. And I think that basic framework was a pretty good one. I think on the other hand, though, that the definition of natural and protected lands maybe could use some work. So Ethan, your colleague, Eric Bieber, who's an environmental law professor at Berkeley, has suggested some areas where maybe additional protections for endangered species should have been incorporated. There might be other goals, like I know the state set a goal of setting aside 30% of all of its land as protected land by 2030. That's not reflected in the current version of 131. But I think that the core idea of trying to define this class of lands that we really want to take care of, defining that up front rather than in response to particular projects, is a really good one, and would start to evolve California land use law more in the direction of what we see in Oregon and Washington, where local governments have an affirmative obligation to protect important lands. Yeah. But there's nothing like the CEQA process that leads to project level delays and delays and delays.
And Kim, just to turn to you, last question, as we're almost out of time here, what do you see looking ahead here? What kinds of priorities are you going to have for potential reform, trying to maybe fight off some of what the changes that we just saw, or what else is sort of in store for you on this issue?
So I think right now the environmental community is really focused on two key fixes that they're trying to get, and we've talked about them already here. One is the definition of natural and protected lands is extraordinarily narrow. The large number of lands being referred to in that list are already protected. You can't develop on them anyway. So it's nice to have that list there, but it's kind of pointless in terms of actually providing real protection. So we're definitely working to try to get habitat and particularly lands important for large conservation, what they call habitat conservation plans that have been enacted over the last like 30 or 40 years to actually facilitate housing development, trying to get fixes so that those plans are not undermined. And then the next fix that we are very focused on is dealing with that incredibly broad exemption for advanced manufacturing because of the concerns to communities.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to stay tuned then. This is definitely still a potentially a changing environment, no pun intended, with the California Environmental Quality Act. I just want to thank you both so much for joining us. First of all, you heard earlier tonight, Liam Dillon, housing and politics reporter for the Los Angeles Times. But still with us, Christopher Elmendorf, professor of law at UC Davis, and Kim Delfino, president and founder of Earth Advocacy. Thank you both so much for coming on State of the Bay and explaining what's at stake with the CEQA process.
Thanks. This was really fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great to have you both with us. And coming up after the break, my State of the Bay co-host Fred Pitts sits down with Booker Prize nominated author and poet Layla Motley to talk about her new book. So stay tuned.
Each week, KALW's Baymade features one local independent podcast or producer.
This week, we're proud to share a new podcast from our very own Hana Baba. Hana shares stories from Sudanese folklore and her homeland in Folktales from Sudan. So tune into Bay Maid all week at 11:30 a.m. for Sudanese storytelling for the whole family, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Yo, this is why Clef Refugee Camp cries little bass sitting up here on the bass. While I'm on this roast, I got my girl L. One time. Hey, yo, L, you know you got the lyrics.
I'm Fred Pitts, and this is State of the Bay. On our show, we profile remarkable Bay Area artists, and our next guest is remarkable in many ways. At only 17 years old in 2022, Layla Motley published her first novel, Nightcrawling. It was an Oprah Winfrey Book Club pick and New York Times bestseller. Nightcrawling was long listed for the Booker Prize, the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Novel, and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. Motley was the 2018 Oakland Youth Poet Laureate and published her debut poetry collection, Woke Up, No Light, last year. Layla's writing has also been published in the New York Times, Condé Nast Traveler, Marie Claire, among others. Today, we are excited to have her on the show. We've invited her to talk about her second novel, The Girls Who Grew Big, which is forthcoming this June. Layla Motley, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You have a long list of accomplishments. My first question is, how do you think about your significant career that's been, what, 3 or 4 years only?
How do I think about it? I don't know. I've been writing my whole life. And so I started writing poetry at 6 years old. And I wrote my first novel at 14. And so Nightcrawling was the third novel that I wrote. And I've written many since then. So in my head, you know, it's like as an artist, you continue to create and some small fraction of that makes it out into the world if you're lucky. And I still don't have as much of a sense of how public it is because most of the work is just me sitting down with a pen and a paper.
Who would you say have been your mentors when it comes to writing?
My favorite author is Jesmyn Ward. And I first read Salvage the Bones when I was 15 years old. And it was just so awing to me that there was a world and space in the literary landscape for the Black girls who have these internal worlds that are rich and complex. I read a lot of Toni Morrison and still am reading Morrison and making my way through her lexicon. And the tradition of Black women writers kind of breaking the boundaries of what fiction can be has created a pathway for me.
Now, we're here to focus on your new novel, but I got to ask you a couple of questions about the debut, Nightcrawling. It's a fiction novel loosely based on a 2016 prostitution and abuse scandal that involved many Bay Area police departments, but started in Oakland. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the case, it was this large scandal at the time, but it's really one of many stories we don't get to hear often about the way that people in power abuse. And so when I was writing Nightcrawling, I was really writing a story about a young Black girl in Oakland who is attempting to live and survive and thrive in a world that doesn't protect her.
Okay. Now, I've watched your interviews with Trevor Noah and Oprah Winfrey, and in each of them, their own way, they asked you how you, at 17 years old, were able to muster the ability to comment so beautifully on the human condition through that book. Have you any insight on how you're able to do that?
I think we all use what we know at the time. And I think I was in a particular position as a young person writing about young people, where there wasn't a sense of distance or removal. So I was able to capture the 17-year-old experience while I was still living in it, which I think is just different, especially because, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Okay. Now, to the new novel. Can you summarize The Girls Who Grew Big? Tell us a little bit about what drew you to write this story, and of course, include no spoilers.
The Girls Who Grew Big follows three young mothers in the Florida panhandle. It starts when a new girl, Adela, arrives in town. She's 16 and pregnant, and her parents have sent her there from Indiana, kind of banished her from her comfortable upbringing to live with her grandmother in Florida, have the baby, leave the baby there, and return home as though she was never pregnant. But when she arrives in Florida, she's brought into this group of other teen mothers who are kind of creating a village where they weren't given one and raising their kids together in the back of a pickup truck.
Wow. What drew you to write about a story that takes place in Florida?
Yeah, Florida was really important to this story because it parallels the experience of being pushed to the margins of society, particularly the Florida Panhandle is a Most of these beach towns are full of people who, when the spring breakers leave, are just living there. These young girls who are finding community within each other where they don't have a lot of access to resource.
Now, I think I understand that the story is written from point of view of all three characters. Why was that important to you?
Yeah, I wanted to show that young parenthood isn't a monolith and can look a lot of different ways. I think we have this weird obsession with teen pregnancy as a culture, from like Teen Mom, 16 and pregnant, even to like Juno and Gilmore Girls, like these weird ways that we both villainize young mothers and also romanticize the idea of young parenthood. And I wanted to create this cast of characters who they're all just mothers who are also at the same time teenage girls. And I wanted to show that there's not just one way to be a good mother. We hold a lot of judgment for all mothers and any and every choice parents make. I also work as a doula. And so a lot of my writing of this book was being immersed in the world of pregnancy and birth and new parenthood and seeing how much criticism and scrutiny there is for the choices that new mothers make, and kind of see the ways that this village that they create is part of how they're able to make a way through the world when they're shunned by their community.
In this case, it's like you're giving them voice to tell their stories as completely as possible.
Right. I mean, to not think of young parents as spectacles and just as parents and people. And I think getting to see and fall in love with each of these girls who sometimes are making questionable choices, but are making choices, the choices that they know how to make, and learning from them and being the best parents that they can be while also trying to grow up and raise themselves and their children at once.
Wow. One of the things I've noticed with your writing, especially with night crawling, is that you've got imagery that is really distinct, like bodies are always in motion, water tends to reach out to people. Can you say anything about how you choose your imagery, specifically in the story that you wrote for Nightcrawling?
Yeah, I started with poetry, so imagery is really important to me. I think that part of why fiction pulls us so deeply is that it's kind of kinetic, it's vibrational, we can feel it. Imagery is a huge part of that, of getting to see into a world. And I think, especially around Black characters, we often don't allow them poetry and lyricism and the ability to have these like really vibrant internal worlds. And so part of the way that I do that is I use first person perspectives and I allow my characters to have these over branching thoughts and these poetic ways of reflecting on the world, because Black kids have as much of a complex inner world as anyone else. But then, depending on what character I'm using and what their world looks like, the imagery changes. So, with Nightcrawling, a lot of it is about Oakland and the world of Oakland. So, a lot of the imagery then has to do with different parts of Oakland, like Lake Merritt, the bay, the sidewalk, even just like different parts of city life, the bus, all kinds of things. And then in the girls, it's very different because we're in this like coastal beach town and we're seeing these girls living off the land and in the back of a pickup truck. So there's a lot of beach and sand, and then there's also a lot of wildlife in there too.
Wow. Now, I know you're from Oakland, and so this is related. Just last year, you wrote an article for the New York Times called Reading Your Way Through the Bay Area. And in it, you cover everyone from Jack London to Chami Orange to June Jordan. It's really a great piece. And so how do you see yourself fitting into and enriching the significant literary history of the Bay Area?
I think Black women have created a lot of the history of Oakland in particular, and yet we're often not the forefront. And so a lot of my work is in just creating a place for Black girls in Oakland and in the Bay, and remembering how this city historically has terrorized us, but also that we have had such an important and critical role in the creation and evolution of the Bay.
Layla Motley, this has been a pleasure. I wish you nothing but continued success with all of your novels, especially the new one coming out. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Girls Who Grew Big will be out in bookstores in June. I encourage everybody out there to pick up a copy. I'm Fred Pitts, and this is State of the Bay.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll hear about the upcoming Barbecue Without Borders 2025 from No Immigrants, No Spice, a Bay Area nonprofit focused on flipping the narrative and shining a light on the contributions of immigrants in our culture. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our website on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard, let us know. You can email us at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang and Heather Hughes. The last segment was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next is Not Born Yesterday, the show about the joys and challenges of aging. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.